It's a couple of minutes after 8 o'clock. Welcome to the Mornings with Ed show. And again, this morning, an important morning because we get answers. And as you know, what we do each and every day, we take a much more focused examination of critical issues. And certainly when in a time of crisis, when your life is the most at risk, it's facts that matter most. Dr. Anita Wong's interest in preventative medicine, anti-aging, and skin health was instilled in her many patients that requested her to continue to care for them after their care in her emergency department. She's a board-certified emergency physician, a fellow of the American College of Emergency Physicians. She spent over 30 years as an ER doctor, previously at UCLA Medical Center, Eisenhower, and St. Mary's Medical Center. She's been with Doctors Without Borders to provide medical aid for impoverished regions of China and was a team lead in China during the 2003 SARS outbreak, along with Doctors Without Borders. We welcome to the program once again Dr. Anita Wong. Thank you for being here, Dr. Wong.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. It's always an informative conversation. And we spoke a few months ago, and we were only about 4 or 5 months into this. We're 8 months into this now. I wonder if you're shocked at our continued inability to test and receive timely results. And I'm wondering if PCR tests are just inadequate because of the late results. And would rapid saliva test be the answer?
So, it is frustrating that testing isn't a little bit more uniform across the nation, which would be helpful in getting things under control. PCR is an excellent test. It's excellent for diagnostic. And the difficulty with it is that it's just not a very comfortable test. I mean, you have to, it's almost like a brain biopsy sometimes. And so getting people to retest, sometimes you need it frequently. Once they've had it once, they don't want to have it again. And then they're also doing the anterior nasal. They've switched to that. And then now there is the saliva test, which is much more, which is much easier. And I think one of our problems is that with the PCR is that, it's very sensitive and excellent in diagnosing. And the issue is that we've not had a rapid turnaround time.
Right.
So then if it's real time in terms of being able to contact trace and know who you've been around, but when the turnaround time even goes out to 4 days and or 2 weeks, you've kind of lost that. So it's really no point in getting it because you're diagnosed, but the infectious period, you're already out there. Unless you went home and really quarantined, but a lot of people want to be in the workforce and kind of keep going. So it hasn't been a good tool in terms of getting us to mitigate the infection because it just hasn't been uniformly available. We have 6 levels of laboratories, and we've only used 2 levels. So in order for them to get all coordinated and get reagents and know the procedure, it's like, baking chocolate cake. If you tell everybody, make a chocolate cake, you might get some that are really dark, dark chocolate, some that are like sweet chocolate, some that are, 10 feet tall, some that are flat, some that are like flourless. You're going to get all kinds of things.
Right.
So that's the issue with our PCR is that everyone's kind of doing their own thing. They're using a PCR. They're having their own little labs. We're not using all of the labs that we could have. So that's the issue with that. And then what is developed, which is really exciting to me, is that it's a more of a public health tool to help us to identify those people who are infectious. So versus diagnosing. So PCR it has a sensitivity, and we use these values called CT cycle threshold,
right,
which kind of tells you the level of sensitivity and how much of the virus is. So a cycle threshold of 40 is about less than 1,000 particles of viruses in your body. So, and that's the sensitivity of a PCR. So when you're at a 1,000 levels of virus,
right,
you're not infectious, but you have COVID. Now your body may definitely develop antibodies and take care of it, fight it off for you, but we have a diagnosis of that you have it, right?
Right. So
the saliva.
I'm sorry. So this is like a rapid antigen test detects
right.
proteins that are unique to the virus itself?
Right. So okay. it's a saliva. Right. And it's done by saliva. And so when you have, so the Abbott was one of the first ones, and they kind of got poo-pooed, but they're really actually a good test, but they are still, there still needs a kit, still needs a device, and still needs a lab to do it. And it's anterior nasal, but they're now have been off, but they're at a CT value of 35, which is about a particles about 50,000. Right? So you're still not infectious, because infectious is about a CT value of 24 at 3 million. Okay. All right. So, yes.
Okay.
The rapid tests and saliva tests are CT values of 35 will identify those people who have about 50,000 viruses. Now, those patients may or may not be infectious at the time, but they're more definitely getting up there, right? Versus
right.
those people with less than 1,000. So if we can identify those people at CT values of 35 and above, we're kind of, it's okay that we miss all those people from CT values of 40 to 35.
Right. Right.
So that's what the FDA wants, is they want all of these, because they want all everything to be, they're more in terms of the diagnostic. So we need to identify it early to diagnose and study and figure out and tell you what's going on.
Right.
But in terms of getting us back into the workforce, we don't really need to diagnose you. We need to know, when are you infectious?
So let me ask,
when do you need to stay at home?
Let me ask you this. That bores right into the next question. If we were to have a home rapid test, let's say like a pregnancy test that you could do at home, would it also eliminate the need for contact tracing? Because the contagious people can be more quickly isolated?
Right. Obviously, this is going to be how well everybody does this. I mean, if we get 70% of the people doing it, we'd have kind of herd immunity type of thing, right? 70% of the people actually, you know, test, we would eliminate the number of infection out there.
Right.
So pretty much if everything opens, and let's say you want to go to the restaurant, and the restaurant says, oh, you know what, here's a test strip, come back in 8 minutes with it.
Right.
Show me in, you know, less than 10 minutes, you fit in, you suck in a little piece of paper, and it turns purple, pink, or whatever it is, and then it says, you know, then you know you're positive. They say, I'm sorry, you can't enter. You know, if it's negative, then they say, oh, welcome, come on in.
Right.
This is available, the technology is there. They're less than a dollar. You can, with the stimulus packet, you're printing up money, passing it out. And in that stimulus packet, you could print up 365, you know, strips for you to want to do every day if you want. Because yesterday you tested, today you test, and tomorrow you turn positive. Then you know tomorrow, you know, the next day you stay home. And then you know you stay home for your 14 days. And then that eliminates those where people are getting diagnosed at CT value of 40, at less than 1,000. And they don't have any symptoms, and they stay home for 14 days, and then they go, and then all of a sudden now they got symptoms, and they got to stay home again another 14 days. It, you know, we've had a lot of the issues of people, workforces having to, you know, not knowing when to quarantine too long, often, but this would eliminate a lot of that because we're just identifying those people at CT values of 35 who have higher levels of viruses. And probably becoming more infectious, and that's when you should stay home and stay away. Or you wear a mask, or you go out and you say, hey, you know, I'm positive today, kind of stay away from me. You kind of know, you'd be more careful, right?
Right.
So it would need everyone to collaborate and be considerate of everybody else and do the right thing. And it's just like, you know, some people are going to wear seatbelts and some people aren't.
Right.
I mean, you know, we have a law for that to protect us. You know, if we can mandate everybody to test, daily test your strips, and then when you go to schools, every day they can, you know, you test your kid, and if they're negative, they go to school. If they're positive, you keep them home.
Well, a couple of things here. I don't know anyone that doesn't wear a seatbelt. It's now so ingrained in us that I really don't know anyone that doesn't wear one. And secondly, you make such a logical point, and your description of going to a restaurant and being tested and, hey, come back in 8 minutes. Of course, your table won't be ready for another 45, but you can come back in 8 minutes. But I love that idea. It sounds so logical. So I think my question to you is that, okay, you were on the team that helped fight the SARS virus. Mm-hmm. Number one, I'm going to ask you how this virus is different, but how has our national response differed if what you're saying seems so logical and seems so available and seems like something we could have been doing months ago? How has this differed than from when you fought the SARS virus?
Well, I mean, I think we learned a lot of lessons from SARS that we could have implemented much more rapidly. I mean, if you look at Taiwan, and they really learned a lot. They've only had 4 deaths. They're a nation of 24 million. I think they had 700 cases, and they immediately started. What they did there was isolate the at-risk people and tested them and try to keep them protected, and then they just went out. And I think you learned that from SARS, because SARS was so highly, the fatality rate was 10%. So the difference is that, the fear of it was much greater. So the isolation and the willing to wear, protect and isolate and quarantine was a lot better compliance. But because this, because our mortality rate is, close to around the flu, people are not as, fearful.
Right.
And I think that, we've gone 8 months and it's still surprising to me that there are people who haven't met somebody who has had this illness. But because of the nature of work that I do, I mean, we had a woman in medical profession in her 50s. She went into a coma with the COVID, woke up with no fingers, no legs, because it's a thrombotic illness. And so, I mean, people don't realize how devastating this disease is because the fatality rate is low and the incidence of seeing somebody that they know of it, they don't realize.
Right.
And then the people who don't wear a mask and don't believe it, and then they catch it and they come in and they say to me, I'm sorry, I really didn't believe. And then they're like, thank you for taking care of me, because now they say, now they realize what's going on.
Right.
And I think that's the big difference, because the fear has really gone down. People are not as aware and just complacent, and it's 8 months and they're just going about their business. Right.
Right.
So whereas SARS, we were able to contain it fairly rapidly and limit the numbers because the fatality was so great. People, met people like,
right,
were scared.
So the patients that you see, the more severe patients that you see, do you prepare them for perhaps years of problems afterwards, lung conditions, heart conditions? Do you prepare them for that as well? Because if you've got it bad now, there's a likelihood you're going to have residual conditions.
Yeah, so there is definitely what's called the long haulers. I mean, some of the long haulers are not admitted, but I mean, I have patients who have fevers for 8 months.
Right.
They're still having daily fevers. They still have a little bit of cough. They just still new symptoms all the time, and just chronic. And this is not an uncommon thing with viruses. Viruses will do this. You get it with the flu, but it's just the percentage. And because the percentage that we're having is greater with this illness. So I definitely don't want anyone to get it, because the long hauler syndrome. I have to check my facts on this, but, at one point of those people who were getting it, where we were getting 70% were developing long-term symptoms.
Right.
Versus much lower, and maybe 10% of those people who contract the flu would get the long hauler symptoms.
Right.
So it's much higher. So this is devastating. You definitely don't want to go to those COVID parties and get COVID and think you're going to get him long-lasting immunity, because, the thing about coronavirus, it's got a sloppy immunity.
Right.
So if it had a nice, robust immunity, it'd be good. Unfortunately, the common cold, I mean, it's very sloppy. That's why we keep getting colds over and over and over. And this is the coronavirus, so.
Right. That makes sense. At least 3 vaccines are now in, or 3 possible vaccines are in phase 3 clinical trials here in the United States. And we all know that a rushed vaccine could be deadly at worst, and certainly ineffective at least. Would you feel comfortable getting a vaccine in November?
Well, that's a complicated question about vaccines for me. I think that when they make it to, phase one is basically, random studies. They're not really human. And then when there's human studies, so first you're doing the animal studies. And then when you get to phase one, you have a small subset of human studies. Phase two is much larger, more like hundreds of people, right? And then they're testing about safety. So then when you get to phase three, it's extremely large. And it should be relatively safe by that time because they've already gone through two smaller trials in humans looking at the safety issues. When you get to phase three, they're looking at efficacy and if this is actually working. So you're hoping that they have already tested out the safety, but of course you're doing now much larger numbers. So you're going to find out, is there going to be issues with those? So it depends on how long they do these trials, how large the studies are, and how well. And the main thing you want to know, is it really effective? Right. So now they may have it safe, but is it effective at all? And so that's my question. Since coronaviruses are fairly sloppy, so one vaccine may not be enough. You may need three. You may need that second booster, the third booster to get an immunity. Right. So that's really one of the issues. And then, the way vaccines are made, they're made with a protein. So if you're allergic to eggs, you can't use it. They have to have an alloy. So that, they used to use mercury, tin, all of these aluminum. So these are not healthy things that you're putting in your body. So, if you have any sensitivities to any of those things, you have to be concerned about, how did they use it? And there's preservatives that they use. Is it a multi-dose? If it's a multi-dose vial, they're putting preservatives for formaldehyde, all these things. So there's issues with those for me on that. In general, I love vaccines because they wipe out diseases. So, yes. But then you need to be a healthy person who can take a few little bit of toxins in you, right? So it depends on, I would like to know, then you want to know exactly what they're using. And then, how safe is it for you in terms of do you have a healthy immune system well enough to also take a little bit of the toxin that's going to be introduced to you besides the toxin of the vaccine, of the antibody. So that's one question.
Okay. Now, this report came out just as you and I were about to go on air, so I know that you haven't had a chance to sift through the entirety of it, but I'm just curious. The University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine scientists have isolated the smallest biological molecule to date that completely and specifically neutralizes the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is, of course, the cause of COVID-19. This antibody component is 10 times smaller than a full-sized antibody and has been used to construct a drug known as AB8 for potential use as a therapeutic or prophylactic against the SARS-CoV-2. What does that mean? What does it mean when they've isolated the smallest biological molecule?
I mean, this is actually really fascinating development. So, you're looking for antibodies, right? So we use convalescent antibodies to actually help treat the ill. And really, the studies have not bared out that antibodies, that the convalescent antibodies have actually worked. So what they're saying is that they just were fishing around because they're big particles, and they fished around and they found this really small particle that they could actually utilize to block the virus. So it's so small that they were, small enough and it actually adhering to it. But this was done in animal trials, so mice. So we don't know if it's going to translate to humans.
Okay.
So it looks good in animal studies. It still remains to be seen, is this going to be effective in humans? But it's really great because we know that the convalescent large bodies of antibodies that we've been giving and then giving that to people, that they haven't attached and they really haven't done anything, right? So now they're saying that it's just like having a, can't think of a good analogy because this was new for me.
Can I chime in with an analogy? Is it like the right sized plug for a hole in a in a dam?
Yes, I was just trying to think of the way to put that, like exactly. So you're putting the, like exactly. So, you know, you've got the good plug and exactly that it's not fitting, but this one just fits just right. So okay. It would be great. It would be excellent if this actually then can translate to humans, but that remains to be seen. So it's a good first step. You know, if they can develop that faster than a vaccine, great, but I don't know. It's going to take time too, because you're still going to have to go through all the different phases, right? So they're not even a human study phase. They're in the animal phase. So they get to phase. So they've been doing the phase one and phase twos a little bit more rapidly if they can get them in there, if they can translate it. So we'll see.
Okay. It sounds exciting. And I was excited when I read it this morning. I couldn't wait to talk to you about that. Yeah. I want to talk for a minute about your practice, what you're doing now. You're focusing on preventative care, wellness, anti-aging, and you've also got a state-of-the-art, innovative bladder care. Talk to us about what a visit to your office looks like.
Well, so now a lot of it's online, so you don't have to worry. Or, you know, I disinfect a lot in the office here, and usually it's only one person and myself. I have HEPA filters. I wear a mask. I actually found one that you can see my face. So I don't know. The patients don't actually say anything that it, they just seem to accept it that I have this clear mask. But anyway, it basically is because I really truly believe that the host, your body, your immune system, if you really take care of it and get it to its best conditions, know what your genetic mutations are, what your genetic propensity it is, and then you have a personalized program, lifestyle, nutrition for yourself, and you do the right things, that you are going to, just be better off and have decreased inflammation and be able to fight things off, right? Trying to get, this metabolic syndrome, the wide girth, and all of those much healthier, having a better microbiome in your gut. So I just do a lot of testing, asking you questions. So I do a lot of research. So before you even come to my office, you've maybe filled out 50 pages. And then I read the book. I know what's going on. And then when you come in for that first hour and a half, we sit down and talk together because I already know your history and I already can talk to you about what's going on and make a plan with you versus spending an hour and a half getting to know you.
Right.
So I like to do the research beforehand, already know you, and then we can sit down and say, what is your main priority? You know, how do you want to do this? What is bothering you? What are you willing to do? Do you want to do testing? Do you want me to just guess at it? You know, specific testing. I like to do that more because, it gives it, tells me exactly. I mean, I have this lady that's in her 60s, right? And she doesn't like to eat vegetables. I'm all about fruits and vegetables. She says, I'm horrible. I'm Irish. I eat fish. I like fish and chips, and I know I don't eat my vegetables. And then she's having these issues, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to get this lab test back. Her lab test in terms of her micronutrients and all of that was the best I've seen in anybody.
It's all that fish and chips.
I was like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? Because it looks good. I mean, now her gut looks bad. So I told her you have a gut issue. She had a little infection. We needed to change that. She didn't have a good microbiome. And she said that she had been taking this green drink. Now, it doesn't have any fiber. So, I hadn't found a product that seemed as good as this one. So I'm going to research it. Because I've used green drinks before and other supplements, so I'm going to research this one more. It's Arbonne, if anybody wants to know, but I'm looking into it to see because I was impressed with this one, just only one study, one person, that hers was so good. I have had, many people and many different things that come in and I test and, it's all off the walls, right?
Right.
So I was impressed with that one. And so I'll look and, see how your nutrients are, your vitamins, all of those cofactors that you need for your mitochondria to make you healthy and make your immune system virulent and resilient. So then we develop a plan and work together. I have multiple different plans. Some people just need the information and they're good to go and they run with it. Some need, me to work with them for 4 months, some with a year. So some of it, because I just don't abandon you once we figure it out. And no, I actually help you. If you And a lot of the side effects is weight reduction. It's not our main goal, but once they get healthy, the weight just falls off because hormones get in place, the gut immune system, all the microbiota get in place. When everything falls in place, they get to their normal weight. Okay. And they're very happy about that. And then the incontinence that I do is just, I mean, I just have people that just, you know, especially, you know, the ones who are getting up at night every 2 hours. Right. They love it because they come in, they slept through the night. You know, they can finish their activities. They can go shopping. They don't have to keep looking for a bathroom or, you know, planning for that. Right. And it's just they just sit on a chair, fully clothed. They get the treatments between 6 to 10. And then after that, there's a maintenance of it. And they're, you know, happy they didn't have to go through the surgery.
Dr. Anita Wong, how do we find you online?
So I have info is my, the website's my name, AnitaWangMD.com is the website. And you can always email me at info and my name, AnitaWangMD.com, or call me at 949-734-0580.
These conversations, for me, they just make my day. I look forward to them, and I'm always, always delighted to talk to you. Dr. Anita Wong, thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We'll look forward to talking to you again. It's the Mornings with Ed Show, 8:28 the time.